This is Carol Foster of 2 Timothy 2:15 Resources, and I am so excited that you're going to join me today as we study God's Word. The response new Messianic believers give when asked why they initially visited a Messianic congregation is, "We knew there had to be more." As we study together, we will begin to see that yes, indeed, there has to be more. For additional study aids to assist you in studying along with us, go to our website, sectim.org. During our last time together, we had completed our overview of Bereshit chapter 13. We found that this chapter dealt with a conflict between Abraham and his nephew Lot. Between the two men, they not only had a large group of people who accompanied them, but they also had huge herds of livestock as well. This was certain to cause conflicts on several levels. First, even though Lot was not Abraham's own son, but his nephew, who was himself a very wealthy man, their entourage included wives, sons, and daughters, servants and their families, as well as all of the livestock. This was a large group of people. Secondly, it had to have been an unbelievably huge task for a group of this size to find water for their herds and or find a place in which everyone could camp safely. The third issue is one that I think we can all really relate to. When you get that many people in one group, there is bound to be contention. Contention over water rights, grazing land, space for camping, and just personal issues between those who are with the different groups. As I was writing this, two things came to my mind. Have you ever taken a group of teenagers or even adults on an outing that lasts more than 24 hours? I have, and let me tell you, it's like trying to herd cats. The teenagers think that most adults, and especially parents, really don't have anything in common with the 21st century. And the majority of them don't think that adults really even know what they're talking about. Remember the saying, "Speak to the hand"? Well, we all know how that turned out. And then there's working with adults. Do you really think that that's any better? Guess again. Several years ago, I was part of the leadership in a large church that had a singles group of over 100 people. Now, I'm an active person, and I enjoy doing new and different activities. One of the things that I did while single was making a bucket list of things that I would like to do, and one of those was to take a cruise. I loved it, and wanted to share the opportunity for our singles group to have this experience as well. As most of you probably know, that when you're in leadership, if you suggest something, you are automatically the one in charge. We ended up with 64 adults going on a 5-day cruise out of Los Angeles to Mexico. Along with collecting monies, making sure everyone had passports, making sure that we had transportation to and from the port, also making sure that we and the church offices had everyone's emergency contact information, and then troubleshooting any issues that might come along, I was also charged with assigning roommates. Now remember, I was working with adults. We hadn't even gotten on the bus to leave for the port until I had people wanting to change cabins, wanting to change roommates, and just wanting. If this wasn't challenge enough, there was always a few of the group that were so late getting back to reboard before we left a port that in each port I was frantically making sure that no one got left on shore. The final straw that broke the proverbial camel's back occurred after we had docked at the port of Los Angeles. If any of you have ever gone on a cruise, you know that they start letting the passengers know the necessity of packing and putting your luggage out in the hallway in front of your cabin at least 3 nights ahead. This task is to be done the evening prior to your arrival at your port of disembarkation. I didn't even think to take a census of the group to see if they had in fact complied with the captain's request. It wasn't until we had all disembarked, picked up our luggage, boarded the bus to drive 90 minutes back to the church, arrived at the church, and were unloading the luggage that the cats ran amok. From the front of the line, surrounding the unloaded baggage, came the cry, "Where are my bags?" I, of course, responded, "I don't know. Where did you put them?" Well, that didn't go over very well. The answer came back, "In my cabin." It took the power of the Ruach HaKodesh to keep me from replying, "You've got to be kidding me. Who do you think was going to take them out of your cabin this morning after you left the ship?" But, praise be to the Father, I didn't say what I was thinking. I really do have to give a big thanks and many kudos to the Royal Caribbean Cruise Line. They actually sent a carrier with this person's luggage all the way back from the dock in Los Angeles to this individual's home. Now, that was with 64 adults. Can you imagine poor Avraham and Lot with thousands of people and herds of livestock? It was no wonder they decided to split the masses. Avraham did not contend with Lot over how they would divide the land between them for the grazing of their flocks and their herds. Instead, he relied on Jehovah, letting Lot decide which portion of land that he wanted, and then Avraham took the other. Avraham allowed Lot to take the best land because he believed Jehovah would give him the land that was supposed to be his, as we read in chapter 13, verses 5 through 8. Later, Jehovah would confirm his promise that he had indeed chosen the land that Avraham was to dwell in. In chapter 14, we find the next potential conflict that arose. This occurred when Avraham was offered the spoils of war after his victory over the four kings that invaded the land that Lot had inhabited. This chapter tells of an early invasion of Palestine by a coalition of four Mesopotamian kings who invaded the plain of the Jordan, subjugating the five cities there, including Sodom. Lot, Avraham's nephew, was among those taken captive. But Jehovah is sovereign over the nations, and Lot was saved because of his relationship to Avraham. In future generations, when the nations of Israel were attacked and her people taken captive by Assyria and Babylon, nations also from Mesopotamia, she would find that her preservation as a nation was assured in much the same way because of their relationship to Avraham. When Avraham returned from defeating the four kings, he was met by Melchizedek, the king of Salem. Let's read about this encounter. It is found in chapter 14, verses 17 through 20. Then, after his return from the defeat of the Chaldorim and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him in the valley of Sheveh, that is, the king's valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now he was a priest of the Most High. He blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And Abram gave him a tenth of all. Salem is believed to be an early name for Jerusalem. We also should note that Melchizedek was not just a king. He was also a priest of the Most High God. And we can read that he's mentioned in other passages as well. Tehillim, or Psalms 110, verse 4, Hebrews chapter 5, verses 5 through 10, and then again in Hebrews chapter 7, verses 1 through 10. The original Hebrew name, Salem, is derived from the root word shalom, meaning to be complete, sound, and also it means peace. This is a common greeting and a blessing among Jews and among Messianic believers, and you'll often see it translated as nothing missing, nothing broken in your life. An interesting side note. If you study these three verses, verses 17 through 20, you'll note that this is the first example of a priest found in the Tanakh. Melchizedek stood before Avram, representing Jehovah. Blessed be Avram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. He then turned and represented Avram before Jehovah. Blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies, referring to Avram's enemies, into your hand, and he gave him a tenth of all. Did you hear that last sentence? He gave Melchizedek the tithe that is due the priest of the Most High God. We have another question to answer from this chapter. why did Abraham not take the spoils from the king of Sodom? Let's read verses 21 through 24. The king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give the people to me and take the goods for yourself." Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I have sworn to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take a thread or a sandal thong or anything that is yours, for fear you would say, 'I have made Abram rich.' I will take nothing except what the young men have eaten and the share of the men who went with me. Honor, Ishkal, and Mamre, let them take their share." No, Abraham would not take any of the spoils from the king of Sodom, because it would show that he lacked faith in Jehovah. We see that afterward, Jehovah confirmed his great reward to Abram, as found in chapter 15, verse 1. "After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, 'Do not fear, Abram, I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great.'" We see that Jehovah not only confirmed his covenant with Abraham, but he also foretold of Israel's future enslavement in Egypt. This chapter's importance in placing the Egyptian enslavement squarely in Jehovah's sovereign and predetermined plan for redemption can scarcely be overestimated. Abram was told that a 400-year period of enslavement and oppression would come upon his family. The 400 years stated is a round figure. However, it is stated more accurately as 430 years in Shemot, or Exodus chapter 12, verse 40. After four generations of 100 years each, Abram's descendants would return to the land. At that time, the oppressing nation, Egypt, would be judged, and Israel would come out with many possessions, as we read in chapter 15, verses 13 and 14. God said to Abram, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions." After that prediction, the covenant between Jehovah and Abraham was finalized. This fact would be highly significant for Israelites who, under Moshe, had just been released from the Egyptian bondage. Note that Israel's return to Canaan was linked to Jehovah's plan for the Amorites, as we read in verse 16. "Then in the fourth generation they will return, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete." The term Amorite is a general term for the inhabitants of Canaan and the lineage of Ham or Canaan. Therefore, Israel's return and the end of the Amorites' iniquity was closely linked. The final verses in this chapter, verses 18 through 21, tell of the covenant that Jehovah made with Abram. "On that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, 'To your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite and the Kenizzite and the Kadmonite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Rephaim and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Girgashite and the Jebusite.'" In chapter 16, we read about Abram's misguided efforts at gaining a son. Oh, Ishmael was the son of Abram, but not the son of the promise. The Nuzi tablets, now these are cuneiform documents dating from about 1500 BC. Cuneiform script is one of the earliest systems of writing. It is distinguished by its wedge-shaped marks on clay tablets made by means of a blunt reed for a stylus. The name cuneiform itself simply means wedge-shaped, from the Latin cunis, wedge, and form, or shape. We find that these documents shed light on why Sarah did give Hagar to Abram so that he may father a child. We find this in verses 1 through 4. I want to read these verses as it's so important to, again, remain in context. "Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, 'Now behold, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Please go in to my maid. Perhaps I will obtain children through her.' And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. After Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Abram's wife, Sarah, took Hagar the Egyptian, her maid, and gave her to her husband, Abram, as his wife. He went in to Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her sight. Giving Hagar to Abraham was in keeping with an ancient custom that allowed a wife who was unable to bear children to give a concubine to her husband in order to gain an heir. What was missing, as noted in verse 2, was a request for Adonai's advice. Abraham's action was not rebellious, just hasty and very unwise. Note the parallel between the statements, "and Abraham agreed," as we just read in Bereshit chapter 16, verse 2, and Elohim's words to Adam, "you listened to your wife," as we read in Bereshit chapter 3, verse 17. Would a son by Hagar be the answer and therefore fulfill the prophecy? No, but her son Ishmael would be greatly blessed, as we read in verse 10. "Moreover, the angel of the Lord said to her," Hagar, "I will greatly multiply your descendants, so that they will be too many to count." Why was Ishmael blessed? Because the Abrahamic covenant stated that any offspring of Abraham would be blessed, even if that offspring was not conceived according to the promise. The descendants of Ishmael are modern-day Arabs, blessed with incredible wealth that silently existed beneath their tents, even at the time of Hagar, the wealth of oil. We see that the animosity between Sarah and Hagar and Yitzhak and Ishmael continue today in the form of the Jews and the Arabs. Chapter 17 relates the covenant sign of circumcision. Abraham aligned himself with Jehovah's covenant sign of circumcision in an account that is sandwiched between two responses of his faithlessness: his attempt to gain a son through Hagar, as we read in chapter 16, verses 1 through 4, and his reaction of falling down and laughing when Jehovah said he and Sarah would have a child, found in verses 17 and 18 of this same chapter. Circumcision was a sign that pointed away from the act itself to something else of greater meaning. It was the external mark or evidence of Abraham's covenant relationship to Jehovah. It was Jehovah's intention to create a pure race of obedient people who would fill, rule, and subdue the earth, a race bearing the mark, circumcision, that showed that they were followers of Jehovah's way. We now find the author returning to the relationship between Abraham and his nephew Lot, as we read in chapters 18 and 19 of Bereshit. This is the account of Sodom and Gomorrah. We discover that Abraham still had to learn about Jehovah's wrath against sin and of his grace toward the righteous. Jehovah desired to share with Abraham how he would vent his wrath against Sodom and Gomorrah for their wicked, immoral ways. We see that Jehovah initiated the conversation because he wanted Abraham to become aware of his grace toward the righteous. I want to read verses 16 through 22. So that you can see, or more accurately, I guess it would be, hear this for yourselves. Then the men rose up from there and looked down toward Sodom, and Abraham was walking with them to send them off. The Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do, since Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, and in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed? For I have chosen him, so that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring upon Abraham what he has spoken about him." And the Lord said, "The outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great, and their sin is exceedingly grave. I will go down now and see if they have done entirely according to its outcry, which has come to me, and if not, I will know." Then the men turned away from there and went toward Sodom, while Abraham was still standing before the Lord. In Abraham's conversation with Jehovah, we find that Abraham explored, but did not bargain with, Jehovah's mercy, grace, and justice. The direct relationship between the Abrahamic covenant and personal obedience is seen in these verses. The blessings of that covenant would come by Jehovah's sovereign promise, but only for the particular people or groups of people that obeyed his commands. Oriental etiquette has a strong emphasis on caring for the needs of strangers. Both Abraham and Lot proved that they were sensitive to these customs of hospitality, which were regarded as a sacred duty, since it was believed that Abraham's guests were sent by Jehovah himself. The promise that he made to be fulfilled through Abraham included a blessing for all people, even those who were strangers to Jehovah's covenant. Because of this promise, Abraham's hospitality has reached out to strangers down through the centuries, even to believers today, through the work of his descendant, Yeshua HaMashiach. According to Oriental custom, a host was responsible for protecting his guests from harm, whatever the cost, as we read in Bereshit chapter 19. Thus Lot offered his daughters to the wicked men in order to protect his guests. The demands of hospitality explain, but do not justify Lot's actions. Why did Jehovah have compassion on Lot, as we read in verse 16? Because Jehovah had listened to Abraham's request and kept Lot safe, as stated in verse 29, which was in accordance with his covenant with Abraham. Jehovah had previously told Abraham, "All the families of the earth will be blessed through you," as we read in chapter 12, verse 3. And Lot was no exception. However, Lot's lineage, known later as the Moabites and the Amorites, would become enemies of Israel, as we see stated in chapters 19, verses 30 through 38. Lot went up from Zoar and stayed in the mountains, and his two daughters with him, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar, and he stayed in a cave, he and his two daughters. Then the firstborn said to the younger, "Our father is old, and there is not a man on earth to come into us after the manner of the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and let us lie with him, that we may preserve our family through our father." So they made their father drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father, and he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. On the following day, the firstborn said to the younger, "Behold, I lay last night with my father. Let us make him drink wine tonight also. Then you go in and lie with him, that we may preserve our family through our father." So they made their father drink wine that night also, and the younger arose and lay with him. And he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. Thus both the daughters of Lot were with child by their father. The firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. He is the father of the Moabites to this day. As for the younger, she also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ammi. He is the father of the sons of Ammon to this day. These two nations, Moab and Ammon, will be remembered forever as the offspring of Lot, or the descendants of Lot, whose land was a gift from Adonai, and who were granted special concessions by invading Israelites. The long history of Israel's relations with these Transjordan nations involved continued hostilities, even down to the time of the Maccabees. But Israel was required initially to spare them by virtue of their ancestral relationship to Abraham. Yet the prophets envision an era of restoration when Adonai will favor anew the descendants of Lot. Historically, the union of Ruth the Moabitess and Judah's descendant Boaz reconciled the alienated families of Lot and Abraham, providing for Israel a great king, King David. Lot's incest had not only resulted in the discrediting of his heritage and the loss of his possessions, but it had also left him with a tarnished legacy that is and will be known throughout time. Join us next time as we continue our study and overview of the Tanakh as we look at Yitzhak, the promised son of Abraham. Thank you for joining us today as we delved into the beautiful truths of God's Word to indeed discover that there has to be more. I pray that the Word applied to your daily life will bring a deeper understanding of His love letter written just to you. Let me remind you that we have additional study aids to assist you with our studies together on our website, SECTIM.org. May this day fill you with the love of God, joy, and shalom. Nothing missing, nothing broken in your life.